The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Rafaela Wakeman. A few weeks ago, I sat down with Mark Plotkin, a partner in Covington and Burling's Washington, D.C. office. We talked about his practice as a national security lawyer working in the private sector. Among other matters, he represents clients before the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. We also spoke about issues currently in the news that highlight the intersection of private industry with national security matters. I'm sure that many of our listeners are aware that national security law isn't just practiced by government attorneys, but many people think of it just as criminal defense work. What does it mean in your case? You know, you have a very unique practice. What does it mean to practice national security law in the private sector?
Well, thanks. Thanks for coming to my office to talk about this today. You call it a unique practice. I guess I would call it an unusual practice that is shared by a small but significant bar here in Washington. A number of very good firms and very good lawyers who do this kind of work. Some of whom have prior government experience and others who don't. But in every case, a national security practice in the private sector involves working with private sector clients who end up having to interface with the federal government in one way or another with respect to the application of national security laws. And it comes up in many different contexts. The one that I tend to focus on here myself has to do with cross-border transactions, foreign investments into the United States that are reviewed by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., or CFIUS. Those tend to get sort of the most press play because they tend to often be large transactions, but not always, that end up on the front pages of the papers, and there's usually a lot of chest beating by pundits and others about the fact that this particular foreign acquisition or that particular foreign investment in the United States is going to trigger national security concerns and the like. But it also comes up in many other contexts, under the Patriot Act, for example. Private sector institutions get served with national security letters that require them to provide certain kinds of information for purposes of trying to stop terrorist activities or the like. It comes up in the money laundering and or the anti-money laundering and terrorist financing context with financial institutions, which have a very broad definition under the Patriot Act and can include casinos, jewelry stores, used car dealerships, and the like. There's all sorts of private sector institutions that come into contact with the national security apparatus, and that's what lawyers like myself are involved in handling.
Well, thanks for that great summary. Let's go back to CFIUS, or the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Mm-hmm. What exactly is it, and what does it do, and why?
So CFIUS, it's got a great name because it does sound like syphilis or some other kind of disease. And I'd say that it truly does strike fear into the hearts of foreign clients for the most part. I mean, it really is viewed with great trepidation, and in some instances for good reason. So CFIUS is a federal interagency committee. It is unique. Not that it's a federal interagency committee makes it unique, but the fact that it is one that operates entirely by consensus. It operates largely in secret. Its activities, for the most part, are secret or classified. And what it is charged with doing is undertaking reviews of foreign investments in the United States, where those investments are going to result in the control, in one manner or another, of a U.S. business by a foreign investor. Oddly, in our system, the reviews that are conducted by CFIUS are conducted on a voluntary basis. I mean, the parties submit, say, a foreign investor or a foreign acquirer and a U.S. party voluntarily submit their transaction to CFIUS for a review. And one would wonder, you know, why would you ever submit a transaction on a voluntary basis to a federal interagency committee? And the short answer is that the committee, which acts at the as a delegate of the President of the United States, has really awesome powers, very broad powers. Those powers include the ability to block a foreign investment, and if the investment has already occurred, to completely unwind the investment after the fact and put the parties back in their original positions, make them return their money or their property or whatever. And there's no statute of limitations on the committee's ability to do that. It can do it 20 years after a deal is closed. And there is no judicial review of the committee's actions. So you might disagree, but you really have no place to go. In light of that, there is a strong incentive to file with the committee because you do buy yourself something when you file. When you file and the committee reviews your transaction and decides not to disapprove it, then you get the benefit of a safe harbor. Once the committee has reviewed it and you go ahead and consummate your transaction, CFIUS is stopped from coming back after the fact and trying to unwind your deal unless you misrepresented something to CFIUS during the process or you violate whatever agreement you might have entered into. All the major cabinet departments are players in CFIUS, it tries to act, you know, relatively promptly. It has sort of a basic 30-day review process. These days, about 40% of transactions go on to be reviewed in a longer second stage, additional 45-day review period. So, you know, your transaction can take 30 days to be reviewed or up to 75 days to be reviewed. Roughly 10% of all foreign, you know, investments in the U.S. go through the CFIUS review process.
Okay. One question that hearing the CFIUS process brings to mind is, how did 9/11 affect the CFIUS process? Did foreign investment completely drop after 9/11? Were foreign investors very nervous about it? What, you know, did Congress respond and change the way CFIUS works? What, you know, what sort of happened after 9/11?
I'm shocked that you're asking me this question. No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I just thought I'd mix it up there a little bit because I can often end up speaking in a monotone, so I figured I'd come up with that. It's interesting. People who've been around for years in Washington and have seen the CFIUS process evolve over time, many of them, particularly if they're not actively doing CFIUS cases now, have a view of CFIUS that is really frozen in time and is pre-9/11. When I run into people who are, you know, say, relatively senior, which is code for old or older, and they haven't interacted with CFIUS for many years, they will describe CFIUS as a defense-focused sort of check-the-box process. if it's a defense-related transaction, you know, one submitted something to CFIUS to essentially get a rubber stamp that everything was okay with your transaction. After 9/11, there was a lot of soul-searching within the federal government about what kinds of things we were doing at home that might make the United States more vulnerable in the future. One thing we saw from 9/11 was that our air traffic could be vulnerable. And while CFIUS doesn't have anything to do with the air traffic specifically, obviously we put into place the TSA and Homeland Security and the like. That's just one manifestation of how the country was trying to, you know, reevaluate its homeland security as a general matter. But another thing that 9/11 did was breathe new life into CFIUS. And as a policy matter, the various agencies that are involved in CFIUS took a look at what it is around the United States that might make the U.S. vulnerable in the event of conflict or to terrorism or the like through foreign ownership. And while that wasn't a new concept for CFIUS, applying it largely outside the defense context was a new step. And it's been an incremental process as CFIUS has had to review transactions. It has kind of explored things sector by sector. And it's been, to some extent, an ad hoc process for CFIUS. One of the very first industries that CFIUS took a fresh look at was the telecommunications sector after 9/11. I think you'll remember the Global Crossing transaction back in 2002, 2003, which was really the first post-9/11 CFIUS review of a foreign investment in telecommunications infrastructure. And in that case, you had a bankrupt telecom company that had a bunch of backbone fiber in the U.S. proposed to be acquired by a Hong Kong-based company and a Singaporean-based company. Initially, CFIUS was reticent to have either of them acquire Global Crossing. Even when the Hong Kong-based company dropped out, there were folks within the administration who were opposed to the idea of any foreign control of backbone infrastructure and telecom. It ultimately took the president to disagree with CFIUS, President Bush personally, and Condoleezza Rice, when she was a national security advisor, to approve that transaction so that Singapore Technologies Telemedia might acquire Global Crossing. So that resolved, you know, one specific policy issue, you know, whether there could ever be foreign ownership of, you know, telecommunications infrastructure in the United States. But one of the great interesting things about this practice is resolving these policy issues on a sort of case-by-case ad hoc basis over time. It's a constantly renewing practice. You know, you never know whether you're going to be resolving, you know, something new in the telecom sector or, you know, oil and gas or, you know, food safety or any one of those kinds of things. That's a constantly evolving process since 9/11.
So you just you mentioned food safety. Mm-hmm. Recently, there was news that an American pork product manufacturer may be acquired by a Chinese company. Could you talk a little bit about the Smithfield Farms transaction?
Sure. You said you want me to talk. I feel badly hogging all of the time here.
Was the word hogging chosen intentionally?
Intentionally, yes. I'm sorry. I know. It's pretty. Hopefully, my daughters won't listen to this, so I'll be accused of being lame as usual. So, on the Smithfield transaction, it's interesting. That is a transaction that I think has, you know, causes a visceral reaction among many people to think, you know, who might not have thought that that would raise a national security issue at one point in the past, but who today, having been sensitized to national security issues, and in particular, people who are familiar with, some of the environmental and food chain security problems in China, visions of, you know, rotting pigs and, you know, the river and things like that. People have, I think, understandably, you know, flipped to think about this transaction and say, well, you know, why wouldn't, you know, one of America's largest, you know, most important food suppliers be treated as a national security concern? And as you know, that transaction, the parties announced, when they announced the transaction, they announced that they were filing with CFIUS,
right,
for a national security review. My own view, and I'm not involved in that transaction, but my own view is that the reason that the parties are filing with CFIUS is not because they necessarily expect that CFIUS is going to have any national security concerns with the transaction. I think that what they are doing is something that we often see parties doing, and that is cloaking themselves, wrapping themselves in the CFIUS flag in response to what they expect will be a more of a public policy or political and media debate about the proprietary about the propriety of a Chinese company owning Smithfield Foods, because I do think that, and you see this periodically, that transactions come under a tremendous amount of pressure in the Congress and in the media on the ground that they somehow raise a national security concern, even though CFIUS itself, looking at technical national security issues, tends to not think that there's a national security concern there. But people use the, you know, kind of the hammer of CFIUS publicly and toss it around as, you know, this is a real problem. So in many instances, parties will say, well, let's just go ahead and file with CFIUS, and then when this thing comes up in public debate, we can say, look, this transaction is getting a national security scrub, and that's a fair thing to do. Mm-hmm. The reason why I personally think that this transaction, you know, with a couple of caveats, shouldn't have a problem on the merits with CFIUS, is that the food supply chain in the United States is one of the most heavily regulated areas that there is. I mean, for the most part, we never worry about our food here because of the system of USDA inspectors and USDA regulation and the like. I'm sure the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, will be impleted into the CFIUS review here, even though it's not a regular member of the CFIUS committee. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you find in CFIUS reviews is that even in relatively or potentially sensitive areas, if that area is already very heavily regulated and there is a well-established, you know, kind of chain of, you know, security protocols and the like, think, you know, nuclear reactors, yeah, for example, and the electric grid and the like, you know, that those aren't areas that CFIUS doesn't care about. But the first thing they do is they look to see whether the area is already heavily protected. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it is. My guess is that what CFIUS will come back to is sort of more basic principles, and that is, when you look at Smithfield, the headquarters is in Smithfield is in the general vicinity of Norfolk and Hampton Roads, Virginia, mm-hmm, and there are, you know, anywhere from half dozen to a dozen, you know, military installations nearby. It isn't particularly close to any of those, but the company also owns 460 hog farms around the country. And one natural question that CFIUS might ask is, are any of those hog farms close to, you know, a sensitive, you know, facility of some kind, military facility or something else we might care about? And if that's the case, it actually wouldn't be all that hard to cleave off that farm or a couple of farms or divest those assets. You don't have to kill the whole transaction over it. And so I can imagine that, you know, I guess one other area that could come up for consideration is if Smithfield itself directly provides, you know, meals to the Defense Department. Mm-hmm. You know, is it providing packaged foods or like? And then you get into some interesting data issues. You know, does Smithfield, through its customer records, know how many meals are going to what bases, and where are they going to? So you have some sense of what the troop strength is. If we have a contingent out with the British on Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, and meals are going out there. Yeah, that's a kind of warped way people think about this type of stuff, but those are the kinds of things you think about.
So it sounds like even in what might be considered an unusual transaction that CFIUS would review, there actually are some regular features of it. There's the announce, some parties announce that they're going to file, some might not necessarily do it. What other sort of features in a CFIUS review are kind of normal? Are there particular mitigation agreements that usually come up? You know, from your perspective, of course.
Right. So, I mean, I've just touched on a major one, which is the subject of geographic proximity. Mm-hmm. The term that the government has for that is persistent co-location, meaning that you, the foreign investor, owns something that is close to something else that might be sensitive. We see that come up, you know, pretty regularly when there are investments in places that people wouldn't ordinarily think of as sensitive, like, for example, acquisitions of gold mines in Nevada, where the investors, you know, traditionally have been Chinese companies, are buying gold mines that are located within earshot of naval air stations that are involved in testing and training using advanced systems and technology. And those have been blocked by CFIUS or unwound by CFIUS after the fact. But in addition to proximity, other issues involve, access to the military and defense supply chain, access to select agents and toxins, things that we might not, dangerous chemicals or poisons and the things that we wouldn't want to have in people's hands, access to export-controlled technologies, technologies that aren't supposed to be exported to China, for example, or to Russia without a license. Mm-hmm. Access to data. This is one people often tend to miss, but data that might be held that provides information about the defense industrial base or perhaps movements of the intelligence community or communications of the intelligence community. Access to or control over critical infrastructure. I mentioned telecom earlier. Access to or interconnection with the electric grid is another area of great sensitivity for CFIUS. We've seen CFIUS block transactions in that area recently. Mm-hmm. CFIUS's concern is a natural one. They don't want a company to be, whether it's doing so knowingly or not, to be utilized by a foreign power or, somebody working through a foreign power to, pull the plug on, all the lights in the Northeast, in the middle of a conflict or something like that.
Right, yeah.
But those are, those are just some of the kind of many considerations that CFIUS will tick through in a review.
Okay. So shifting away from CFIUS a little bit, we talked about Smithfield. Mm-hmm. What other current issues in the news are examples of national security colliding with the private sector? Are there any particular ones that you're really interested in or would like to talk about a little bit more with me?
A great example of an area where national security, as you put it, collides with the private sector, made itself well known in the media just over the last several days. And that has to do with the activities of the National Security Agency and other elements of the U.S. government through the secret program known as PRISM, mm-hmm. Access to individual records of internet communications and telephone communications and the like. Much as I would like to discuss that with mm-hmm. you, I can't.
Okay.
Because I have conflict, so mm-hmm. I can't. But that is in itself a way to make your probably the best illustration for your audience to mm-hmm. to see how any company that is involved in any respect or touching a program like that is going to need legal representation to, interface with the FBI or the NSA or the Justice Department or the intelligence community in general. Other areas where we see this coming up, as you were actually coming into my office and mm-hmm. we were talking about this, I mentioned that I'm going out of town today to go meet with a company that this sounds kind of mundane, but is involved in the sale of used cars. And there have been a spate of instances over the last several years where used car dealers have been indicted for aiding and abetting money laundering and in particular terrorist financing by agents on behalf of Hezbollah. There's actually a very well-known system by which money makes its way from Hezbollah and other Iranian affiliates into the United States to purchase used cars at auction. They're shipped back to Africa. In particular, they are sold in Africa for some, multiple of what they were purchased for in the United States because there is a demand and there's not a lot of supply. And what happens then is that the money that was dirty, often is drug money, comes into the United States. then it becomes profit that is associated with the sale of a used car and is able to be put into a bank and, you know, put on the books of a legitimate company in Cameroon or something like that. It's illegal to money launder. And so companies come, you know, this is part of the bread and butter of a non-CFIUS practice, is dealing with those kinds of issues. We deal with that for people who are involved in the precious gems world, for financial institutions, of course, all the mm-hmm. time, and the like. Another area that we see periodically come up relates to the service of national security letters on internet service providers and the like, and dealing with questions about whether or not in responding to a national security letter, the respondent is somehow acting solely within the scope of what is permitted, or whether things you think about when you do this is, if the national security letter asks for X and you provide X plus Y, thinking that it's called for by the letter, but it's really not, mm-hmm. Do you have the kind of protection from liability for Y that you turned over if it wasn't specifically called for by the letter? Part of what drives this is the fact that you get certain protections from liability when you are acting in response to, national security requests from the federal government. But that protection from liability only extends to the request, to the scope of the request, and not anything you happen to throw in. If I happen to throw your passport information in there just for the fun of it,
right,
that may not be protected.
Oh, okay. I won't be giving you my passport number anytime soon.
Oh, I've already submitted it, actually, so I'm sorry about that.
Man, I thought I deleted that file on the web. We've only got a few minutes left. From your perch, your perspective, again, you said you have a very unusual practice and perspective. What do you see as the most significant challenges in national security law today?
And by the way, I know you're trying to keep to a schedule. Mm-hmm. I would say that, from my view, I'm billing this at full rates, so we have all the time in the world as far as I'm concerned. And we'll give you a statement on the way out. But one of the principal issues that I think we have does come up in the CFIUS area again and again, and that is this continuing debate about the tension between wanting and needing foreign investment in the United States, in particular right now to help reinvigorate the U.S. economy. And you can't go a day without reading in the newspaper about a state governor and delegation that has gone over to China or to, another Russia or someplace else. Israel, India, offering tax incentives and all sorts of other things to try to attract foreign investment to, Ohio or Illinois or, California or whatever, constantly doing that. Many states have offices specifically set up to try to develop this. And, of course, you've got U.S. ambassadors and the Commerce Department and the State Department and others, roaming the world, the U.S. Trade Representative, touting the benefit of investing in a stable political economy like the United States, and then at the same time having companies from around the world, not just China. China, unfortunately, and partly because of the nature of the things that Chinese companies would like to invest in, and partly because of the kind of the challenges of the bilateral relationship today between the U.S. and China, Chinese companies tend to have, to some extent, a harder time in CFIUS, although the vast majority of Chinese transactions are approved by CFIUS. But there are transactions from around the world that have been turned down, including from Belgium and from Israel and from India and all sorts of other countries, Switzerland. To some extent, CFIUS is an equal opportunity offender if you're a foreign investor. What CFIUS is trying to guard, against national security concerns, the real problem is the fact that, a foreign investor doesn't necessarily know that the company that they're investing in may be located near something that is sensitive or may have something that is sensitive. And they won't necessarily know before they go before CFIUS review that they're going to have a problem. This may sound selfish, but and self-promoting, but the reality is that the best thing though those companies can do is they can engage good counsel, qualified CFIUS counsel in advance. Because one of the things that CFIUS lawyers do is they will go out and informally reach out to contacts in the intelligence community and to in the defense community and the Justice Department and the like to explore the sensitivities around particular assets, around particular countries and companies and the like, to see whether there is a path forward for a particular transaction. More often than not, though, what happens is that you get a call from a client that a transaction has just been signed up, and they want you to get CFIUS approval yesterday. And at that point, you really don't have the latitude to try to, lay the groundwork or maybe even restructure the transaction to get rid of assets that might present a problem so that the rest of the transaction can be presented, as a whole. I think that the tension between communicating that we want foreign investment and at the same time we want to protect ourselves against foreign investment is one that requires a lot of work and a lot more explanation, particularly when I travel abroad and I see other countries saying we're not really sure the U.S. really wants our money given the way we see companies treated by CFIUS. I don't think that's a fair perception, but it is a true problem, and I think that the government is well aware of that problem.
For listening to the Lawfare podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.